Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS LP 98.9 FM in Schenectady. I'm Guy Schaefer, and today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first HMM correspondent Alexis Goldsmith talks with Jamela Anderson about the Free Food Fridge Project in Albany. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia speaks with Elevate 518 members Brea Dottie, Destiny Harris, and Camille Hobbs about their organization and their Black Lives Matter event held on August 1st. Then Carson Ray speaks with Troy Regenerative Farm Representative Mark Russo about urban animal husbandry and its benefits in the city of Troy. After that, in part six of the seven-part conversation, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks with a longtime activist, educator, and labor organizer David V. Walker. And finally, to close out the show, Jared Singer talks with Dr. Yana Liang, department chair at the Department of Environmental and Sustainable Engineering at the University of Albany, about PFAS chemicals, remediation of PFAS chemicals, and their impact on the environment. But first, here are the headlines. A letter from more than 700 Adirondack residents was delivered to the Essex County District Attorney asking for a full investigation of off-duty Cohoes police officer Sean McCown's firing shots in a confrontation with Black teenagers in June. McCown, who apparently was drunk, allegedly made false claims that a Black male fired at him first. They also want the DA to investigate how the police handled the investigation of the matter. McCown is being allowed to retire from the Cohoes police force without disciplinary action being taken against him, which would allow him to be hired by other police forces. TikTok threatened legal action against an executive order issued by President Donald Trump that would ban the Chinese social media app from doing business with U.S. firms. The app has been at the center of an escalating technology war between the U.S. and China. Trump also took action against WeChat. Congress went home for the weekend, despite failing to come to agreement on a COVID-19 relief package. A resolution does not appear to be close. Democrats want a relief package three times larger than that proposed by Republicans. Community residents are protesting the removal of park benches on July 31st from Parker Park on 3rd Street and State Street in the city of Troy by the Madden administration, apparently in an effort to make it harder for homeless individuals to gather. The removal of the benches coincides with the city's ouster of Street Soldiers 2, a volunteer program that provides meals for the homeless in the park every Thursday, a program that has existed for over 3 years. Governor Cuomo said Friday that he would allow children statewide to return to classrooms for the start of the new school year, citing the state's success in battling the coronavirus pandemic. New York State has had over one-fifth of the nation's COVID-19 deaths, despite having only one-twentieth of the nation's population. Cuomo issued a statement in which he said, "Everywhere in the state, every region is below the threshold we established. If there's a spike in the infection rate, if there's a matter of concern in the infection rate, then we can revisit. Parents have expressed concern that reopening students will put students, teachers, and families at greater risk, particularly in poorer schools with greater crowding and fewer supplies." Governor Cuomo has signed an executive order, which effectively extends until September 4th the moratorium on eviction proceedings. Cuomo said he will keep extending the order as long as the pandemic continues. Cuomo says, "I signed the law, and the law is clear. Until when? Until I say COVID is over." Housing advocates have argued that the eviction moratorium does not go far enough. While it stalls the eviction process for now, Cuomo has made no movements toward rent relief or rent cancellation, despite the push from tenants' rights advocates and small business owners, as well as a bipartisan majority of Americans who support canceling rent. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Guy Schaefer. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, send an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org. To start off the show, Jamela Anderson, yoga teacher, doula, and activist, joins Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Alexis Goldsmith to discuss Free Food Fridge Albany, a project with the mission of free and accessible food for marginalized neighborhoods and people. No strings attached. The effort has raised thousands in donations and received dozens of inquiries from individuals wanting to help, from maintaining the fridges to painting them. It's all part of dismantling racism and an effort to reduce barriers to access that are based on race or income.
This is HMM correspondent Alexis Goldsmith, and I have the pleasure of introducing Jamela Anderson to the show. She is a local yoga teacher, doula, and community activist. Welcome, Jamela.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you're here specifically to talk about your latest project, the Free Food Fridge Albany Project. Can you tell us what that is?
So the Free Food Fridge Project, it's a mouthful, no pun intended, is a project to help fight food injustice here in Albany, but also the Capital Region. So I'm hoping that this project grows beyond just the city. And it already has because, you know, we are partnering with a few organizations like Sanctuary and Troy. And, you know, hopefully we can get a bunch everywhere. And so it's not just, I call it Albany, just like I like to kind of always use Albany as like the pinpoint of location. But it is a free food program that is geared to help fight the food apartheid that's going on in Albany specifically and beyond. So basically it is a way for people just to have access to food without jumping through any hoops, without having to sign any paperwork, to not have to prove their income. A lot of the programs I feel that we have here, and just like with EBT and a lot of just like the food programs in general in the country, you have to like prove that you deserve to have free food. And I'm trying to go around that. So this project is just like, there's no hoops to jump through. There's nothing to have to like prove to anybody. You deserve to have free food. You deserve to not have to tell anybody why you need free food. And you should have access to free, healthy foods.
So if there's no, you know, regulatory hoops to jump through, what is the distribution method for the food?
So right now, just because of COVID, we are working with local farms and local restaurants so that we can have like a little bit of an idea of like where the food is coming from. This program, I did not create, not like, it's not the first of its kind. So there are a lot in LA and Oakland, and bigger cities. New York has a ton. So they often have people like in the neighborhoods filling them. But again, just because of COVID, I want to have like a more streamlined version of that right now, just until things kind of clear up. COVID has presented like a huge like loss of food programs for people. And so I want to like be able to like make sure that we can be as healthy as possible and as safe as possible.
So the program has already received incredible investment from the community. Can you talk about the funds that you've raised for it and how you're going to budget those funds? What are they going to be used for?
Sure. So the funds, we've raised a couple of thousand dollars already, and the folks over at Clark Hospitality are actually having a fundraiser tonight until 10 p.m. and they're donating 10% of all money made throughout all of their businesses and donating it to this initiative. So the money raised is right now I'm trying to pay like Black, Indigenous, and people of color to be a part of the program. So if you are an artist or you want to, if you want to work with me on the admin side, or there might be times where some of the farms can't produce as much food to stock the fridges. So like the money will be allocated to those people. And then also to like actually shopping if we need to get more food to kind of amp up what's in the fridges. And because there are a lot of small farms working with us, it might, you know, there might be when it gets colder that we do have to purchase more food. So those funds will be allocated for that and sort of like in a little bit of a reserve. And then as the project grows, I'd like to have more than just food and veggies and stuff. I'd like to have, from the start of the project, we're going to have PPE supplies. So just some of the money will go to supporting that. When it gets colder, I want to have gloves and hats and things. So there've been a lot of donations, but I'd like to also be able to sustain, because sometimes people can only donate once or twice. So this way I have, again, that reserve of money to help amplify what's already happening at the fridges and what donations we've already received.
And how many locations do you expect you'll have?
That's a good question. So I keep calling them bids. I've been putting bids out to a lot of other spots, and I have a lot of people kind of on the pavement doing work for me, asking local residents if they can put fridges in their, like, on their lawns or, you know, in the alley or next to a building, somewhere that's brightly lit. So maybe not so much alleys, but like if it's a bigger alley, it's between two really big buildings. So right now I have like 10 of those out. So the fridges aren't placed yet, but those are just like the spots that we're going to hopefully work with. And then the more fridges I get, the bigger the project can grow. So I don't want to have a cap on how many I want to have. I just want to be able to like sustain how many we do have, so that every one of them is getting the same amount of love.
And how will the fridges be maintained? What's the structure there?
So I've been very fortunate enough to have a lot of volunteers. So my goal is to have at least two volunteers at each fridge that check on it periodically. So that means 3 to 4 times a week, we'll do maintaining of the fridge, cleaning out the fridge, restocking the fridge, just checking on the fridges in general. And then those people will kind of they'll report back to me. And then, you know, if they're like, okay, well, this didn't work here, or, you know, this, there was like kind of, you know, someone left trash next to it, then we'll use that information and figure out how to pivot to make sure that the fridges stay maintained and that they, you know, they don't become like an eyesore and more of just like a happy thing to look at and an exciting thing to look at.
And you're calling on local artists to paint them?
Yes. So I've, again, gotten tons of DMs and messages and emails about folks donating their time. So like I said, like black and brown artists, I'd like to pay. And I'm asking non-black or brown folks to donate their time and to volunteer so that we can kind of keep circulating money back into the black and brown community, and also paying people who have like lost their income. I'm an artist of sorts, and I've lost a lot of income through COVID-19 because, you know, things just aren't happening. So I just want to make sure that we're dispersing money back into the community.
And your post initially on this project said that, you know, offered this as an opportunity for reparations. Can you talk more mm-hmm. about what you mean by that?
So the work that I've been doing the past few months has been raising funds and giving them back to the community. So this is sort of like that same idea. So if you're helping with this fridge, it's so that people who are marginalized and systemically oppressed get access to the same things as people who are not. And it shouldn't be a privilege to have healthy foods. So working with local restaurants is a good way to be like, okay, just because folks can't pay doesn't mean they don't deserve the good food. That's what I mean in this program about reparations. Like, we're giving back to people who don't have as much potentially, and then being able to bring them up to the same playing field as us and not have to feel food insecure, because there are a lot of people who are food insecure as well as home insecure, as well as money insecure. And so if there's one thing that we can do that helps elevate everybody, then it starts with food.
What gave you the idea for this project, Jamila?
Honestly, people came to me because I started doing some research on a lot of the farms around Albany and a lot of the community gardens. And I was starting to see a lot of the community gardens pop up in lower income neighborhoods, but not necessarily serving lower income folks. So that kind of, it annoyed me a little bit because I'm like, why is the space being taken up by mostly non-black folks and then not feeding the people who are living in that neighborhood, or again, marginalized or systemically oppressed people? So the idea was like, started from that sort of my frustration. And then as I started to do more research, I started seeing that there were sort of like a lot of problems and that a lot of people were kind of saying the same thing. You know, that being said, there are a lot of farms that are serving black and brown and marginalized communities, especially like a place like Soulfire Farm, Collard City Growers. Like, there's a lot of people who are doing what those farms are intended to do. But here in Albany, I'm finding that that's not the case. So it was more of a way to be like, okay, like, how can I bridge the gap between these smaller farms, these farmers, and then people who actually need it? People are always looking to donate. There's tons of food like programs in Albany, but there may not be as much spreading of resource or information to get to those resources. So I want these fridges to act like that. I want it to almost be like a bulletin board, like, hey, there's food in here, but then people can put up flyers like, hey, there's a free food kitchen. There's a, you know, there's a food drive. There's, you can get meals all summer for children. You can get meals all winter. You know, I want it to be sort of a hub. And again, to all, like, to amplify all the things that are already happening. So this is not an original idea for me, but it is something that I saw past, you know, just online. You know, just on Instagram and Facebook, and people who live in the city bringing it to me. And I'm like, okay, how can Albany do this? How can I do this? And it's been a tremendous outpouring of support. So it's been really cool.
Awesome. Well, we're almost out of time. Is there anything I haven't asked you about the project that you'd like to discuss?
No, if you think that your spot might be a location, anybody listening, if you know a place that might be able to donate money, goods, food, that's really time. Where we're at. Like I said, I have a ton of bids out on locations, but the more locations, the better. And then there are a lot of people who are donating fridges. So it's not so much of a lack of resources, but it's like a lack of spaces. So that's really where I want to focus my attention going forward.
This has been Jamela Anderson, yoga teacher, doula, and community activist. So keep an eye out for those free food fridges in Albany and the Capital Region. Thank you, Jamela.
Thank you so much.
That was Alexis Goldsmith speaking with Jamela Anderson about the free food fridge project in Albany. Next on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory talks with Bria Boddy, Destiny Harris, and Camille Hobbs of Empowering Ladies, Elevating the Voices of Albany to Excel, or Elevate 518, who organized the August 1st Black Women Matter event in the park at 21 Delaware Avenue in Albany.
So the music you hear in the background is music from the Black Lives Matter event for Black women that's taking place at 21 Delaware Avenue in the park, right near the Boys Club. Lots of folks, lots of people, lots of music. So this is Livonia Mallory for another episode of Reclaiming History. For my listeners, tell them the name of your organization, your names, and how they can reach your org.
So my name is Bria. The organization is Elevate 518, and you can reach us through email, which is elevate518newyork@gmail.com, and the New York is NY.
And your name?
Hi, my name is Camille Dobbs, and I'm a part of Elevate's research and social media committee.
First, I've got to say, listen, I love the t-shirts, you know, the multi-hued hands that you have on your t-shirts for, Black women. It's beautiful. How did you come up with that?
Basically, you wanted to emphasize on the different color of Black women, because some Black women are darker, some are lighter. But just because you're lighter or darker, that doesn't take away how much you matter as a Black woman. So we basically wanted to emphasize on, you know, the Black women and let other Black women know that we are here as a support group, as a solution group, and all of that.
Yeah. And our slogan is all about amplifying the voices of, you know, Black women and just making sure that their stories are told, whether that's from us or the community.
So, you know, my colleague there was messing with me, talking about I'm old school, I'm an old head and all that. And that's true. You know, I'm 60 years old and I got no problem with it. Right. I've been around long enough to know, right? So when I see young sisters like yourselves really getting it done, it just inspires me. It says, listen, I can pass the torch.
Yep.
I can sit down, rock in my chair. If you need somebody to come out and throw up the power symbol, I'm there. But I ain't got to fight as hard because you ladies are on the battlefield. Right. Tell me, what's the number one thing you're trying to achieve? Number one thing you've got to achieve, let's say, in the next 60 days. What's the number one thing you gotta see happen?
Definitely awareness of the oppression that Black women go through, and also letting the Black women know that there is some type of outlet that you can come out to reach. And let people know that we're here for solutions and to come up with solutions, and definitely let people know what we're doing right now.
So I definitely want to connect with Sam Fine and Carolyn McLaughlin. I feel like, you know, we should be able to have these sit down and these conversations with you guys as a community, as a Black community. You should be involved in these topics because they concern you. Your citizens are Black and brown.
Now, the Young Sisters at the radio station hit me to a word. It's called misogynoir, which is the hatred of Black women. And I had the woman, the professor who developed the term on my show talking about it. You know, how real is this hatred of Black women in American society?
It runs really deep. Just even when you look back to history, you know, if other marches and protests and the media doesn't want to cover like our stories, it's okay. We'll do that, you know? And we have media outlets that are led by Black and brown women and men that are trying to do that work. So, you know, we just want to keep telling those stories and having accountability. So I want the men to have accountability and, you know, share their platform and their space and let other Black women, you know, come up and do that work as well.
Tell my listeners, what is the one thing you're trying to accomplish 60 days from today?
Definitely one of the things that we're trying to accomplish is awareness of mental health. In October, we're definitely going to be going into like the domestic violence. So we want to be able to bring awareness to mental health and partner with different people who have already did it, so we don't reinvent the wheel, but we just make it a little smoother.
So if there's some women, Black women, listening to the segment right now, what's the one thing that they can do to help you fulfill your mission over, let's say, the next 60 days?
Definitely visit our Facebook page or Instagram, which is Elevate518, and like our page so you're aware of what's going on and you can come out and support when we have events for you. And definitely donate as well, because and most organizations, nothing is free. And if we want a real change and we want different for our kids, our Black and brown kids, we need money. So definitely those are two things. Like our page, share our post, and let other people be aware of what's going on, what we're doing.
So what if it's an old head like me? You know, old folks don't like Facebook. Right. Let's just be honest. Right. We don't understand it. We don't know how to maneuver through it. How does a person like me, who's like over 50, how do we connect? Because we're not gonna connect through Facebook.
And you can reach us through email, which is elevate518newyork@gmail.com. And the New York is NY. Every Thursday we meet at the Boys and Girls Club at from six to eight. So you can definitely stop by, say, hey, this is my number. What can I add or what can I do for you? Whether it's just sharing flyers or giving us a word of advice. A lot of people forget, like, we still need the mentors and advice. We need to know what you guys did that didn't work. And we also need to know what you guys did that did work. So definitely mentoring and being a part of that is super, super important.
Tell my listeners your full name and your title in the organization.
So my name is Bria Bodie, and I'm a part of the executive committee, but also part of research and fundraising.
And your title within the org?
My name is Camille Dobbs. I am a part of Elevate's research committee and the social media committee.
Thank you for participating in another interview. This is Lavonia Mallory with Reclaiming History, airing on WOOC 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
That was Lavonia Mallory, who is currently on sabbatical from WOOC, speaking with Bria Bodie, Destiny Harris, and Camille Hobbs of Elevate 518. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM also in Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. Next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Carson Ray speaks with Mark Russo about urban livestock and the benefits of being more connected with your food system.
Hello, today we're talking with Mark Russo from the Troy Urban Regenerative Farm, who is also a volunteer at the Sanctuary, and we're going to be talking about urban animal husbandry. First off, I'd just like to ask, how did you get into having livestock in the city?
Well, first I want to say hi, Carson, and thank you for having me on the show. I've been interested in animal agriculture for a long time. When I first started learning about farming about 8 or 9 years ago, I learned a lot about how most of the ways that animals are raised in agriculture is like extremely harmful environmentally, socially, ethically, et cetera. And so I thought that since I was interested in farming, that raising animals in a good way would be a way to have a much bigger impact on the food system. And as a young person who's often struggled with finding consistent, well-paying employment, et cetera, I haven't been able to buy my own land or reliably access land outside of the city. The city is where I live, and Troy is the city where I live, and I love living here. Seeing as I wanted to raise animals and I lived in the city, that's just what I did. So I chose the smallest animals that I could find that sort of have the lowest footprint and impact so that I could produce the most food and gain the most experience with a very small amount of space.
How do you ensure animal health in just in this setting?
Well, you can't be sure of anything in farming, but the choices that I've made to make sure, I'd say, so it's sort of different for the two species, because birds and mammals, especially rabbits, have very different needs. So with the rabbits, if I had my druthers, they would be raised outside and have fresh access to grass. But obviously without the space for that, I don't have that currently. They're raised in cages in my backyard. So I give them cages that are larger than the recommendations for industry. And then I make sure that I give them fresh greens every day. So I go out, instead of being able to have the animals harvest their own feed, I go out and do it for them. So I'll go out with a sickle and a laundry basket and cut grass, or I'll take tree trimmings and make sure that they get fresh grass every day. And then in the wintertime, I grow what's called fodder. So I have wheat and barley and other seeds that I'll sprout, like to make wheatgrass or microgreens, and then I'll feed those fresh greens to the rabbits so that they have access to fresh greens all year round. And I would say the best way to make sure that you have healthy animals is to start with really healthy stock. So I went out of my way. I drove like 200 miles round trip to, I found a farm that was raising the rabbits in the way that I wanted to. And so I went out of my way to make sure that I started with healthy animals that were adapted to the kind of system that I'm doing. And I've recently just made an agreement with someone who has a decent amount of land in the city of Troy, basically like a big lawn. And we're going to be building a small tractor, which is another word for a movable pen. So the young rabbits will be able to go out and be on the grass, which and be on fresh grass, which will be really nice for them. But honestly, with rabbits, it's tough because they're very susceptible to a lot of diseases. And there's a disease called hemorrhagic fever, rabbit hemorrhagic fever, which is kind of like rabbit Ebola, which is rapidly spreading from the Southwest in the United States. So there's a lot of risk, especially when you have breeding stock that you've invested in, like I have, with having your animals being outside and being able to contact the wild rabbits, because they often can carry diseases. So that's why I kind of have this hybrid system where the adults are in cages protected, and the younger ones, who tend to be, they're less susceptible, and they're also less of a risk for me financially to be outside. And then with the quail, I hatched our own quail. So we ordered eggs online and I got an incubator and we hatched them. So instead of them having to be stressed out by getting shipped through the mail, which is typically what happens with chicken chicks, and it's okay. That's a standard way of doing it. And the animals, chickens are adapted to being able to go without food or water for at least 24 hours after they're born, but quail, not so much. So they were hatched out by us and raised by us, so they've been fed the same high-quality, local, non-GMO feed, which is also a huge factor, making sure they have really high-quality feed that's not full of chemicals and antibiotics that are going to adversely impact their health. But they've been raised consistently by the same people in the same way, in the same conditions. So they're adapted to the conditions that they're in, which are is a deep bedding system with the quail. So instead of them being on cages, not being able to scratch around or anything like that, they have access to, they're in an enclosure that has deep bedding underneath, deep 4 to 6 inches of wood shavings, so they can dig, they can scratch around. There's a bunch of sticks in there, so they can practice their normal behaviors of being in the underbrush. And we bring them fresh hay and fresh grass every day also.
That's all really interesting. Do you consume all the meat yourself, or do you distribute it?
I don't eat all the meat myself. So the quail are predominantly, at least at this point, for eggs. We had about 50% male quail, which is typical when you hatch. That's about the average you get. And so we harvested those for meat. So I sold a number of them to a local business, and then I've sold some of them to friends and used them to barter. And with the rabbit, because of the local regulations, you actually can't sell rabbit if it's not processed in a licensed facility. You are, however, allowed to sell people a live rabbit and teach them and give them the opportunity to process it themselves. So I did that. I had a workshop last week where some people who were interested came, and they were able to dispatch and eviscerate the rabbit, and then they kept that. So that's sort of how I sold them this time. The rest of them I'm keeping for personal consumption, but I'm working it out with a local farm that has a licensed facility, so I'll have meat for sale available in the fall.
So you've talked a lot about the being able to have a reliable supply of food. Would you say there are other benefits to raising livestock?
I would say so. I mean, I love animals, and I mean, I have a dog. I've had plenty of cats in my life, and I think that there's a lot of value in those kinds of relationships, but those are a different kind of relationship than you have with an animal that's providing you food, either by producing eggs or something like that, or with its body. And I think that that's something that we've gotten really separated from culturally. Recently, for most people, food, comes in a package you get at a store. And so for me, having that level of intimate connection and experience to be able to know for sure how the animal was raised really well and being an active participant in all phases of its life just has a value that you can't put a price on. And I also think that there are people I know that there are the people who buy my products who also who aren't necessarily interested in doing it themselves, but are interested in making sure that they get food that is raised that way. And I think that, especially with meat, which is, like I said earlier, has such a huge impact. Obviously the system that I'm using right now, it's not perfect. It's a work in progress. This is only my first year really practicing this, and everything always has room for improvement. I'm really satisfied with the way that we've been able to manage the animals and to produce enormous amounts of compost for my home garden. So not only am I raising meat, but I'm also getting large amounts of vegetables and improving the soil in the gardens where I'm working. So there's a whole cascade of benefits. And part of the mission was also to do it in a way that could allow other people who are interested to see how to do it so that they feel empowered to do it themselves. So I've actually sold more than half of my rabbits to other people who are interested in starting their own herds. So that's cool.
Oh, wow. What would you say to someone who wanted to get into raising animals?
Contact me. If you're in the area and you're interested, I sell breeding stock, and I'm happy to give advice and help coach people. I learned a lot through experience working on farms with larger livestock, but I also learned a lot watching YouTube. There's an enormous amount of information out there. And I'd say if you're interested and you're really dedicated, start small, but go for it. Most of these animals, even chickens, take about as much care on a daily basis as like a cat does. You have to make sure they have food, they have water, you have to clean up after them. They don't take an enormous amount of work. And you can keep a small number of quail need a very small, if you're, say, you're interested in eggs, quail need a very small area in order to thrive. And so you can keep, enough birds to give you the equivalent of like 2 to 4 chicken eggs a day in a very small area, in like a 6 to 8 square foot area. So yeah, just go for it. Try it. If you don't like it, the worst that can happen is you have to eat them. So
coming near the end here, is there anything you'd like to touch on?
I kind of want to reiterate that there's a real power and connection that comes with the direct experience. And I think that even if somebody doesn't want to do it themselves, that they should experience, if people eat meat, that you should experience harvest of an animal and that process, just to understand more what it takes, the work that it takes to put food on your plate and sustain folks. And so if anybody's interested in that or learning more about raising animals on a small scale, that they should feel free to reach out to me on Facebook and Instagram at Tiny Urban Regenerative Farm. And yeah, I'm always interested in connecting with people who are interested in small scale or any kind of scale livestock raising and sustainable agriculture.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for meeting with us today. This has all been really fascinating.
That was Carson Ray speaking with Troy-based farmer Mark Russo. Next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaks with longtime activist, educator, and labor organizer David V. Walker at his home in East Greenbush, New York. You're about to hear part six of a seven-part segment in which David Walker speaks with about his family and early life.
So tell me some more about the labor movement, though. Did you ever go with your mother to demonstrations or pickets or something like
Labor Day marches, yeah. Well, Labor Day was a big day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went marching the Labor Day parades. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did you ever become a union organizer? I mean, like as a consultant?
No, not on the ships. I went out and shipped as a merchant seaman.
You was the merchant?
Yeah, before. And I usually took care of stuff on the ships with the union. Mm-hmm. I was an NMU member. I was an NMU member. But then we had this war on the ships. We fought, man. We actually fought, you know, because our union was a left-wing union. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I knew something about organizing. I always took the minutes. I did all that kind of stuff. To go, you know, so actually when I went to Lincoln, I really wanted to be a union president. That's what I really wanted to be, was a union president.
But you never was in a union per se?
Yeah, I was already in the ILGWU. Okay. And all you had to do is keep your book up.
Right.
And I had an NMU book. Mm-hmm. So you keep your book up. You dues play a member. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. I know it is in the unions, yeah.
Now, in the union during that time, well, some union, the question of racism inside union.
Yeah.
Did you, what were your first experience in terms of racism?
My mother wasn't working at the time. My father said, you don't work, you stay home, raise this boy. Mm-hmm. But my mother could sew. My grandfather was a tailor.
Right.
Okay. Girlfriend prevailed on her to go to the shop, which was in Brooklyn. You could walk to it, actually. And my mother went there, and that's the first time she had worked with a power machine. See, she started out with a treadle, and then they got a little motor, and she had a little electricity and stuff like that. But they had these power machines, which were very fast, mm-hmm. very fast. And the shop was mostly white. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one day, while they're working, goons come in, right? And they said to the boss, they took their boss over to the side and said, we're taking over your shop. We're taking the girls down and put them in the union, right? Except those two, which was my mother and her friend. And the boss was a stand-up guy. He said, if you're taking my shop, you're taking all my workers. And that's how my mother got to be a union. Didn't take her long before she was shop steward. Didn't take her long before she started hearing all these girls, Italian girls and stuff, how they were exploited and their money, never got their money, and her husband took their money. And so she started teaching them how to survive, you know? Yeah, so So she was a leader. So Dubinsky heard about her, and he moved her up. He moved her up.
But I'm saying you was a. She was telling you these things?
Oh,
or
yeah.
You was experiencing
No, she actually tell me. We're at the table. We'd be talking about it. Somebody come knocking on the door. It'd be somebody from the union who was having trouble with the husband and crying and all that. Yeah, they knew where we lived.
So tell me more about your politics, you know, how you develop your political outlook. And what is your political outlook? Let's say.
I went to Jefferson School too. That was a left wing school, like a night school.
In
New York City. Yeah. So I went down there, and you mingled. Then I went to Camp Unity, which was a communist camp. So you know, I was around all that stuff, and there were people always coming in the neighborhood trying to pick people off to join the party and stuff like that. So a lot of recruitment going on and exchange and stuff like that. Yeah. So yes, so I was right around then, and then I sat around with guys when they came back from the war. Mm-hmm. There was a bunch of guys that came back from the war, couldn't find jobs. They had a thing called a 5220 club. You get $20 a week for 52 weeks. So the guys couldn't find a good job. They just didn't, you know. Some of them wised up. Start taking civil service exams. Mm-hmm. See, some of them went on a different kinds of life. But you're getting all this. You're hanging around. You're hearing all this. What I heard was, if you go to sea, you can make $100 a week. I'm gonna get my papers. Why? They couldn't find enough people who wanted to go back to sea after the war was over. They wouldn't stay home.
Right.
Okay. So happened I had there's two black captains, Captain Molzak and Captain Godfrey. They're both from St. Vincent's in the West Indies. Captain Godfrey lived on my block. And I used to look out after his family. Make sure that the coal was in the bin. Well, I tell you, I had my block. I had a locker. He used to come on off a trip. He'd be elegant. He'd come down, and he'd have a box on his arm. He'd call me over, and he'd give me this box, right? And in the box were Milky Way candy bars. And that was like a real treat, man. Right? I could give it to my boys. So when he came home, I asked him, would he sponsor me down to the Union Hall? Got my papers right away. Everybody see me. Yeah.
Now, you said you have a lot of books. You told me you have a lot of books in the house.
Yeah.
You
know?
And I guess you did a lot of reading.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the key books that you have?
I got everything, but they're all over the downstairs. I read The Boys. I read everybody. Boy. I read, in fact, I got right over there, I got The Boys. I have...
Did you ever see The Boys?
Yes, I did.
Did you ever see Malcolm?
Yes, I did.
Tell me some more people you saw.
Uh-huh.
What are some more other people that you've seen, you know?
I worked for A. Philip Randolph.
A. Philip Randolph?
I worked for A. Philip Randolph. Adam Clayton Powell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everybody, really. Your name.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking with longtime activist, educator, and labor organizer David V. Walker. That was part 6 of a 7-part interview. You can find the rest of their conversation online at mediasanctuary.org. And to close out the show, Jared Wesley Singer of the Water Justice Lab speaks with Dr. Yana Liang, professor and chair of the Department of Environmental and Sustainable Engineering at the University of Albany. Among other things, Professor Liang studies PFAS substances, which have become the focus of environmental justice movements in Hoosick Falls and at the Norlite Incinerator at Cohoes. In this interview, Professor Liang speaks about remediating PFAS substances.
I'd like to welcome Dr. Yana Liang, and thanks for joining me, Yana.
Thank you for having me.
Can you introduce yourself and give an overview of PFAS chemicals in the industry and in the environment?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a professor and a chair of the Department of Environmental and Sustainable Engineering at UAlbany. My research has been focusing on pollution remediation, various organic waste valorization and conversion to fuels and chemicals. Back to the remediation, yeah, I have been working on remediation of PFAS for several years. So these chemicals, very, very difficult to work with. One reason is because this family includes over 5,000 different structures. It's a huge, huge family, highly diverse, with different structures, different physical chemical properties. Also, these chemicals are termed as PBT, so that is persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. So presence of these chemicals in the environment is bad for the ecosystem and also bad for the human beings' health. So that's why we are developing different remediation technologies to remove these chemicals from different environmental matrices. These chemicals have been used in industries starting from 1950s, kind of like magic chemicals. You know, it's very, very useful. So that's why it's used in many, many places. Household-wise, for example, you know, carpeting, clothing, even cookware. So there are so many places, so many products contain these kind of chemicals. In around 2000, we realized these chemicals are dangerous.
As you were discussing the diversity of the PFAS family, do PFOA and PFOS get more attention because they are the most common, or are these the end degradation product of the rest of the family?
Yeah, you're right. So number one, these two chemicals, PFOS and PFOA, they have been in the spotlight the most among, you know, all of these kind of PFAS family members. Number one, they are very, very persistent. They are end product of degradation. So the precursors in the environment can be degraded to these two. So that is one reason. Another reason is for industry purposes. You know, some industry, they just use PFOS, some just use PFOA. As a result, you know, we see high concentration or higher concentration of these two than the rest of the others.
What are some of the methods of PFAS remediation in surface water? And can PFAS be cleaned up in the soil and in the subsurface?
We look at remediation technologies from three aspects: physical, chemical, and biological. We know PFAS is everywhere. And if you ask me, can we remove these chemicals from different environmental matrices? I would say yes. Including me, you know, lots of researchers are working very hard to study different remediation approaches or technologies. So we have a lot of technologies we can use. In terms of surface water, I'm not aware of any surface water treatment system in place, because surface water, consider, you know, rivers and lakes, you know, the volume is just too huge to work with. So I think right now the remediation has been focusing on degrading these chemicals, removing these chemicals from highly contaminated sites, either groundwater or soil. And then sorption is the number one approach for doing this kind of work.
By sorption, would that be like a filtration process?
Sorption, basically you have sorbent, and normally we use either resins or activated carbon. So we pass contaminated water through this sorbent or filtering bed, and then the contaminants, PFAS, will be sorbed to the sorbent, and then the water passing through the filter will be clean, hopefully free of PFAS.
Do you work at any particular contamination sites?
Well, not yet. So I have been in discussion with several contaminated sites and companies, and it is difficult. I mean, I can understand. So the responsible parties or companies, they have been very, very cautious in disclosing any information related to PFAS and what data they have in terms of this contamination because of legal issues, legal concerns. So my lab doesn't have contaminated samples yet. But with all these contaminated samples, we can still do lots of work. You know, we can buy standard chemicals. We can see how these chemicals can be or how can they be degraded. So we can still do lots of interesting works.
Yeah, absolutely. So the firefighter foams, I believe, were previously using the 8-carbon PFOS. And now that this has been recognized, they're switching to the shorter chain C6 PFAS chemicals for use in firefighting foams. Do these shorter chain PFAS chemicals add any additional complexity to remediation?
So the shorter chain PFAS include C4 to C6. On one hand, you know, we have tried thermal degradation of long chain and short chain PFAS. So the short chain PFAS, they are faster to be degraded compared to the long chains. So that's a plus. On the negative side, these short chain PFAS, they tend to escape sorption. So when you have this mixture of PFAS going through the sorbent, you know, long chain can be sorbed much, much better compared to the short chain. And then another thing we have found out is they are fairly mobile because they have a higher water solubility. So think about in surface water, you have plants growing. So the plants can uptake, accumulate different chemicals, including PFAS. So the shorter chain PFAS tend to move up to the plant shoots or leaves, so the above ground parts. So that can affect the food chain system.
With your plant research, do you foresee the uptake into plants as a form of remediation or also as a study of natural bioaccumulation?
We see it as both. So number one is we can certainly use plant uptake. So another term is phytoremediation to uptake these contaminants from either soil or sediment or water. Once these chemicals are transferred to the plant tissues or shoots, you know, we can do a thermal process to destroy these chemicals in plant tissues. So that is something we have done already. And another thing is to study this, how plants uptake these chemicals, you know, from the ecosystem perspective. If we know certain plants, you know, accumulate more than the others, we may be able to develop certain ways to make decision which ones we should grow. And then, so that is from an environmental management perspective.
The Norlite facility in Cohoes, New York was burning firefighter foam for the Department of Defense as a form of disposal. From your research, do you have any indication of what the safety of PFAS combustion may be or what the combustion products are?
The thermal process we have been studying use temperature only like 300 degrees C, so it's not that high. So it's much, much lower compared to combustion temperature, so that is close to 1,000 degrees C. Disposing AFFF through combustion is a debated issue. Some researchers report, you know, some PFAS cannot be burned completely even after incineration. Another one is the combustion process may convert these PFAS to small molecules, and these small molecules may be even more or still toxic to the environment. For example, hydrofluoric acid, HF, so that is highly toxic. Another way for disposal, especially AFFF, is dispose them at hazardous waste landfill. But again, you know, there's other disadvantage to this approach. You know, long-term speaking, we really don't know whether these chemicals can leach to groundwater or the surrounding environment.
Do you have any comment about the establishment of the maximum concentration levels for PFOA or PFOS in drinking water at 10 parts per trillion?
Yeah, 10 parts per trillion, 10 ppt. I think that is very, very good for people who live in New York. I guess different states have different standards. I think 10 ppt for PFOS or PFOA is quite low. Yeah, I welcome this MCL standard. We have to have low MCLs given the persistent toxicity of these chemicals in the environment.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
As researchers, we are happy to do some research, find solutions to solve these real-world problems. Yeah, we are excited on working on this project, and we welcome any collaboration opportunities with businesses, industries, so we can really move the dial.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Jared Wesley Singer of the Water Justice Lab speaking with Dr. Yana Liang, professor and chair of the Department of Environmental and Sustainable Engineering at the University of Albany. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or want to comment on our work, send us an email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org. As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.